And welcome to another episode of G220 Radio. This is Ricky Gantz with Mike Miller, and we are continuing our series tonight on the Second London Baptist Confession of Faith, the 1689. We are continuing back on this series. We took a break for a little while, and we are coming back with Chapter 9 of Free Will. And we have, once again with us, Pastor Mike Waters. He is at Heritage Reformed Baptist Church in Canton, Ohio, and really excited to have him back with us tonight to go through this very important chapter talking about free will. So, Pastor Mike, welcome back to the program again.
Thank you, Ricky. I appreciate it.
Now, Mike Miller, you are at a 1689 church yourself, right? Or is it it's a Southern Baptist church?
So our elders are held to 1689 in order to be an elder. But to be a member, it is just the BFM 2000.
Okay.
So that's the Baptist Faith and Message 2000 for our listeners, I guess, the shorthand we talk about.
All right. So that should then you're familiar, obviously, then, too, with the 1689. We're going to get into that here tonight. We've been doing this series, and what we're trying to do is look at the 1689 Baptist Confession of Faith, and then we have these pastors come on, like Pastor Mike tonight, to explain to us what is being said in the confession so that we can better understand it and that we could better then, because of our understanding of it, apply what is being said there. Because one of the things we see, I think, today is there is a lack of confessions out there, or there's a lack of what's the other word? When people have their statement of faith, they can be, as you mentioned, the Baptist statement of faith. How'd you say it?
BFM? Baptist Faith and Message.
Baptist Faith and Message. And sometimes what we can see with some of these things is they can be very vague and not detailed. But what I love about the 1689, it is very detailed. And so if more people would hold to a confession, they would, not that a confession is above Scripture, but that the confession is conveying what the Scriptures teach. And it really keeps you, I think, and guards you from a lot of the errors that we see out there in the world today in Christianity. So, Pastor Mike, again, thank you for coming on and talking about this. Why don't you go ahead and get us started with this by explaining this chapter, what we're dealing with tonight in Chapter 9.
Well, the chapter is entitled Of Free Will, and there's five paragraphs. It's a relatively smaller chapter in comparison to the average size, but as you mentioned, Ricky, very important and often misunderstood on both sides of the fence. Of course, the Arminians largely misunderstand the doctrine of free will, and then some Calvinists, I think, misunderstand it as well. Our confession is very wonderfully balanced and navigates between both of those errors. But if you have, Ricky, if you're familiar with Pastor Sam Waldron's exposition of the confession, it's very helpful. And there's a more recently published, somewhat enlarged edition that's out. I have the original one that came out in the 80s. But he summarizes the chapter as well with outlines, and then he gives a good exposition of the paragraphs in the confession. And he suggests that there's really two main divisions in this chapter. He says, first of all, there's a definition of free will in paragraph one, and then there's the distinguishing of free will in chapters 2 to 5. So chapter one is really paragraph one is really a summary statement in terms of a definition of free will, or really of the will. And then paragraphs 2, 3, 4, and 5 define that will as you find it in four states. Paragraph 2 is man's state of innocence. Paragraph 3, man's state of sin. Paragraph 4, man's state of grace. Paragraph 5, man's state of eternal, or his eternal state. So you have a broad definition of free will, and what does it and what is meant by the terms. And then the confession descends in paragraphs 2 to 5 to explain that will as it functions in those four areas. So the first paragraph is God has endued the will of man with that natural liberty and power of acting upon choice that it is neither forced nor by any necessity of nature determined to do good or evil. And this, of course, is just a tremendous introductory paragraph to describe what is meant by will. And you probably know also, Ricky and Mike, that traditionally in Reformed theology, we distinguish within the soul of man three faculties. And that is the mind, the heart, and the will, or the understanding, affections, and the volitional aspect of man. And those aren't so much three parts of man, they're really just viewing the soul of man from three different angles. Man's soul has those faculties. He was created with those faculties. He has those faculties in his fallen state. He has those faculties in his recovered state, and he'll have those faculties in his eternal state. Simply put, man has a will. He was created with a will. He has a will in his fallen state. He has a will in his recovered state, and he has a will in his eternal state. But the important thing about verse or paragraph one is that the will is free, and by free is meant, it's not forced. And I think that's a part of the problem, Ricky. When you begin to deal with the issue of free will, a lot of Calvinists, especially young Calvinists, misunderstand sometimes that distinction between forced and fallen. Man has a free will, okay? But you have to define what that's, what do you mean by free? When somebody asks me, Ricky, does man have a free will? I have to then ask the question, what do you mean by that? Mm-hmm. Our confession affirms, I think the Bible affirms that man has a free will. If you mean by that, he acts freely. He's not forced to do anything. And if you look at the three proof texts that our confession gives there, you might notice Matthew 17:12 is a text where Jesus speaks about his the wicked Pharisees and how they were acting wickedly freely. They were not being forced to act wickedly, and so they were acting of their own volition. I think that's what our confession means when it says it's neither forced nor by any necessity of nature determined to do good or evil. And James 1:14, of course, is the text that speaks about how when man sins, he sins because he's first drawn away and enticed by his own evil lusts. I think this just really underscores the fact that while God is the sovereign over sin, he isn't the cause of sin. And sin is to be attributed here to man and to the freedom of his will. So God doesn't force a man to sin. Man acts freely in accordance to his nature. So man has a will because he's made in the image of God. And that will is either bent toward doing good or bent toward doing bad. All right, so we can move into paragraph 2 unless there's any questions or comments about that first introductory paragraph.
So would you say, and I think I know the answer already, but I'll just kind of bring it out there, that really kind of the difference between what the 1689 is saying and then maybe an Arminian is really how do we define the word free in free will?
Because we're going to see, Michael, when we get down to paragraph 3, whether the confession describes man's will in a state of depravity, that man's will is free, but a slave. Mm-hmm. Or perhaps we can say it's free to act in accordance with its nature. and its nature is bad, thus it always chooses bad. The will isn't sovereign. Man's will isn't free in that it can act contrary to its nature. A dog is free to act like a dog. A bird is free to act like a bird. And a fallen sinner is free to act as a fallen sinner. Yeah, so it really does come down, Mike, to the definition of free. I think we'll get to that a little bit further, too, here in a minute.
Yeah, I think also, Pastor, is as you mentioned this already, I've posted this before. I've posted chapter 9 of free will on my Facebook once before, and I got some pushback from someone who was a professing and confessing Calvinist because of that first paragraph, because they were looking at that first paragraph. Whoa. We don't, what is this free will? I'm confused. I thought Reformed people don't believe in a free will. And so I'm glad that we were able to kind of, distinguish that and explain that to let people know that we do believe in a free will. There's a guy at work that I was talking to about this issue when it comes to Calvinism and the view of the doctrines of grace. And he said, well, so you don't believe that man has this able to make choices. And I say, no, man makes choices in accordance with his nature. And that's what you're saying, right? So it's like, because we have this sinful nature, until God changes that nature, we will continue to make those choices that won't be pleasing to God.
Absolutely. Yeah, the first paragraph, one, justifies God, okay? It ensures that God isn't blamed or isn't described as the cause of sin. Secondly, it also renders man responsible. Mm-hmm. Man isn't a beast. Man isn't a rock. Man is a moral creature made in the image of God. And it also is important too when at a practical level, I mean, in terms of evangelism, and then even with regards to when we get to paragraph 4 and how the will functions in a state of grace, or even how God calls us out of state of nature into a state of grace. I think the next chapter, isn't it? Chapter 10 is on effectual calling. And you'll see in that chapter where it describes effectual calling as, or it says about effectual calling, that God doesn't call us against our will, that he changes our hearts and makes us willing. And he works upon us as rational creatures. And you find that in Psalm 110, where the Father says of the Son, your people will be made willing in the day of your power. So God doesn't call us against our will. What he does is he makes us willing by changing our hearts. Yeah. And we'll see that too, when we get down to paragraph 4. It's a very exceedingly important point, this first paragraph, with regards to all these subsequent issues. Very important, for sure. Yeah. If you err here, you're going to end up in hyper-Calvinism or Arminianism.
Yeah.
Okay, so paragraph 2 finds man or describes man in his first state, and that is his state of innocency. Paragraph 2, man in his state of innocency had freedom and power to will and to do that which was good and well-pleasing to God, but yet was mutable so that he might fall from it. Now here's, I think, from my humble perspective, one of the most difficult things to explain, and there are difficult things to explain. We don't believe that the Christian religion is against reason. We believe it's a reasonable religion, but we do believe that our reasons are limited, and they're fallen. And even though they're recovered, they're not perfect. And so there's some things we just have to believe, and cannot fully understand at present. And one of the things that's most difficult is how God can make a man perfect and yet able to sin. And that's what the Bible tells us. And we know that Adam and Eve were made perfect because the Bible tells us that. And we know they were made mutable, that is changeable, able to sin because they sinned.
Yeah.
And when they sinned, they were held accountable. The Bible doesn't say, cursed is the ground because of my decree. It says, cursed is the ground because of you, Adam. And again, it goes back to the need of this first paragraph, where it vindicates God, and it also condemns man. It underscores the criminality of man. And so this first, the second paragraph speaks of man's will in innocence, that is in paradise, pre-fall. Mm-hmm. It was, his will was good. His heart was good. Thus he willed to do good. And yet his will was mutable, so that man was created in such a way that he could will to do evil. And Ricky, you know, sometimes you can word that more neatly and read the good systematicians to help. But at the end of the day, the text, we got two texts there. And if you look them up, Ecclesiastes 7:29, it says something like this. The preacher says, Solomon says, I know this, that God made man upright, but man sought out many inventions. And I don't know how do you put that together other than you just have to believe what the Bible says. And Genesis 3:6, of course, is Adam and Eve when they were in that state of innocence. And Eve, of course, being tempted first by Satan, succumbed to his temptations and then tempted her husband. And if you read the passage, it just simply says she saw that the forbidden fruit was good. She desired it. And she took it and she ate and she gave it to her husband and their eyes were opened. So it's just important to understand that man, and it is very important to understand that man was made good. And that's very important because all the paragraphs, Ricky, always build on each other. The guys who wrote these things were master theologians. They didn't just put the chapters in the order they're in haphazardly, and they didn't just throw the paragraphs together without thought. They beautifully fit together. And they build on each other. But the important things to understand in paragraph 2 is, one, that man was made with a good heart and thus a will that reflected that good heart. And yet that will was mutable because it could also will sin because it did. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah, I think going into 3 here, because that I think, as you said, the way that they lay this out, you know, paragraph 1 and then paragraph 2 here, the innocence being in that state when they were created, it lays it out, because some of those objections you do get from those who argue against a reformed view is, well, then that would make God the author of sin. And I think as you're explaining that there for the listeners to really understand what's being said from the Reformed view of what's said here in the 1689 is this, as you said, it takes away the guilt from God being the one who is, as the scriptures tell us, he is not the author of sin. And I think that's very important to start that way. And I completely agree with you, Pastor, and have been learning that through going through this 1689 series here on the G220 radio program and even at church at Grace Covenant, is going through this series where you see how you mentioned each chapter builds upon each other. And then each paragraph in the chapter is building upon, as you said, it's really written. And because it's written back in before 1689, but comes out in the 1689, that's why I thought it would be good for this type of series to help people understand what they are trying to convey to us, because I think there is a lot of misconceptions. And this Absolutely. Is very important.
Now think of this, Ricky. God, who willed evil, right? He willed it. We speak of his will in two senses, right? We speak of it in his decreed of will and then in his revealed will. Mm-hmm. He doesn't will it in terms of his revealed will. He forbids it. But he's willed it in terms of his decreed of will from eternity. So he's the sovereign of sin. He wanted, in that sense, he desired it, he willed it in order to manifest all of his perfections. And he can only show all of his perfections if there's sin, evil, and the fall. Because wrath presupposes sin and guilt, and mercy presupposes sin and guilt. Mm-hmm. So God willed there to be sin, and he did it in such a way so as to ensure that his hands are clean from it, and yet he brought it to pass through his creation in fulfillment to his eternal will or decree. It's quite masterful mm-hmm. and very amazing if you think about it. Okay, so we find then that man fell at the end of paragraph 2, and now paragraph 3 describes man and his will in a state of sin or depravity. Man, by his fall into a state of sin, has wholly lost all ability of will. See, there's the key phrase. Mm-hmm. Has wholly lost all ability of will to any spiritual good accompanying salvation. So as a natural man, that is a man still in the state of nature, unsaved, being altogether averse from that good and dead in sin, is not able, again, another key phrase, by his own strength to convert himself or to prepare himself thereunto. Now, I think it was back in chapter 6, right, where we find out about man's depravity. And in back in chapter 6 in paragraph 2, our confession describes what we call total or complete or whole depravity. All the faculties of the soul are fallen, right? Are corrupted. And I mentioned that there's historically three faculties: mind, heart, and will. The understanding, the affections, and the choice. Again, because when we speak of the will in a narrow sense, we're speaking of the chooser. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's the mind, there's the heart, and there's the will. Back in chapter 6, in paragraph 2, there's a very accurate description of man's total depravity. Well, a consequence to man's total depravity is what we call total inability. And this is what we come to in chapter 3. Because man is totally depraved, he's totally unable. He's unable to do anything good. He's unable to prepare himself for salvation. He's even unable to come to God, left to himself. This is the result of total depravity. Because man is totally depraved, all of his faculties are corrupt. They're not as corrupt as they could be otherwise, but nevertheless, the point is each faculty is corrupt. That's what it means by total. The whole man, he's in total corrupt, his mind, heart, and will. And because of that, he's lost all ability to will any spiritual good. Okay, so we come to perhaps the most, I guess in some sense, controversial of the paragraphs of the chapter, and to the heart of what we commonly refer to when we speak of free will. When the Calvinist says that man doesn't have free will, this is really what he means. It doesn't deny that he is a creature made in the image of God, and as a creature made in the image of God, he retains a soul. His soul isn't eradicated in the fall. He still has a mind, he still has a heart, he still has a will. But what it does say is that that will isn't free to act at odds or in contrast to his nature. Now, there's, I can remember I became a Christian in 94, and I think it was probably in 95 or 6. I was actually at a module taught by Sam Waldron on eschatology, and I took along with me this book by Arthur Pink, Sovereignty of God. And I can remember reading this book over that week of lectures on eschatology, and he basically made the statement. He has a chapter here, by the way, called God's Sovereignty and Man's Will. And I know that some of the chapters have been taken out of this original edition in the Banner edition. That's a whole debatable topic, whether or not they should have been. Ian Murray suggests that if Pink were here today, he no longer believed those two chapters, so he took them out. But this is the original that has all those chapters in it. I would prefer to get that if you could, and then make your choice decision whether or not Pink deviated towards the end on those two chapters. But nevertheless, the chapter on sovereignty and man's free will is excellent. And in it, he basically makes something statements like this regularly through the chapter. Man's will is a slave to his heart. And because his heart is corrupt, he only and always wills corruption. Or another way he put it elsewhere in that chapter, Ricky, was man's will isn't sovereign, but a slave. His will isn't sovereign. It cannot act outside of its nature. And again, I use the illustrations of a bird and a dog. A bird is free to be a bird, but it's not free to be a fish.
Right.
And a sinner is free to be a sinner. And we believe in common grace, Ricky, even if you don't like the terminology common grace. And Pink didn't like the term common grace. You can read it in his attributes of God.
Yeah, somebody just mentioned that to me the other day. I posted something and mentioned common grace, and they sent me a private message and said, hey, the Reformed faith doesn't believe in common grace.
Then that person doesn't know the Reformed faith, because the Reformed faith does believe. In fact, Arthur Pink believed it. But historically, we lump mercy and grace and love under the attribute of God's goodness. That's just a Reformed way of doing it. And okay, so Pink said, when you go to his chapter in his attributes of God on the grace of God, he says that if you read every verse in the Bible about grace, it's always efficacious. And that's really true. That's an overstatement, but it's not really that wrong. But you know what he said, Ricky, when he came to the chapter on God's goodness and God's mercy? He says there's a common goodness and a specific goodness. There's a common mercy and a specific mercy. And do you know what he says when he gets to the chapter on love? There's a general love God has for all men, and there's a specific love. Mm-hmm. He just didn't like the term grace, because he was a biblicist in perhaps not even the best way, but in the broad sense, he knew his Bible. He read it four times a year. Mm-hmm. He knew that grace was almost always associated with the elect. But nevertheless, the point being is this. We do believe in common goodness, grace, mercy, or love toward the reprobate, toward the person who's not elect and will never be saved. And so we do believe that God innate, our confession actually speaks about a civil good. Native man can do what we call civil good, but he cannot do anything spiritually good. Mm-hmm. And that's why Paul can quote the Psalms in Romans 3 and say that there's not one who does good. There's not one that seeks God. Jesus said, no one can come to me unless my Father draws him. Unless my father changes his heart and makes him willing in the day of power, he will never come to me. Ricky, do you know why people have never come to Jesus? It's not that they lack the faculties to come. Native man isn't a rock or a beast. He's made in God's image. He has a mind. He has a heart. And he has a will. The reason man doesn't come isn't because he lacks the faculties. It's because his faculties are corrupt and opposed to it. And that's why Jesus can say in John 5, you're not willing to come to me. And in John 6, you cannot come to me. And the reason why you cannot come to me is this. And this is how the bulk, not all, but the bulk of Reformed theologians tend to put it. The reason why man is unable to come is because he's unwilling to come. And it roots it in his hatred toward God and his aversion to spiritual things. The Bible says that man hates God. The Bible says man hates the law. He hates Christ. He hates true morality. And conversely, he loves sin, corruption, lies in the world. Here's why, poor sinner, this is what I would tell a sinner. This is why you, sinner, will not come. Don't blame God's decree. Don't blame total depravity or even inability. Just blame yourself. You won't come because you don't want to come. Because if you wanted to come, you can come. Ricky, the Bible says, come if you want to come. Right. And listen, whosoever wills. See, Ricky, this is a historically biblical, confessional, reform view of depravity and inability, and it answers all the questions, or at least most of the questions, from both the hyper-Calvinist and the Arminian. What happens is a lot of people don't get this balanced Calvinism, and they can't make sense of so many texts. A balance, any Calvinism, Ricky, that can't make sense of all the texts of the Bible or all the groups of the texts of the Bible, I don't want that. Historical, evangelical, confessional, biblical Calvinism isn't embarrassed or ashamed of any text. Now, that doesn't mean that we all agree on interpreting each text the same. because me and you may disagree on how to interpret 1 John 2:2 and other texts, 1 Timothy 2, that God wills all men to be saved. There's Calvinists that differ in those interpretations of those texts. Furthermore, there are texts that may be less easy to interpret. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. But this form of Calvinism that's represented in our confession, guys, it allows us to honestly address all these texts. Okay, so I said that man doesn't lack the faculties to come. And that's an important statement. It was men like Edwards, who not everybody likes as much, perhaps, as I do, or the Edwardsian disciples, those who kind of came after him. Furthermore, also the what we call the Marrow men that were in the 18th, low to the mid, high, or basically all through the 18th century, Scottish Presbyterianism. They love to make the distinction between what they called natural and moral ability. Maybe you could use physical or spiritual, because natural might throw you off there. But just use that term. That's a classic from, that's straight out of Edwards and his disciples. I think it's in the Bible. Okay, natural ability. Man has a natural ability. By that is meant he has the faculties to come. He can understand. He can. He has a mind that can process the data. He has a heart and affections and a will that because he's made in God's image, and thus he retains those faculties. He doesn't refuse to come because he lacks the ability in that sense. But he does lack the ability in the moral sense, that those faculties are now depraved and fallen, and they don't function as they did in paradise. They're averse to coming, et cetera, et cetera. So man's ability isn't, or let me put it this way, his inability isn't a lack of faculties. It's a lack of those faculties functioning accurately. And this, Ricky, this allows us to speak to our neighbors, right? This allows us to speak to our children as rational creatures. And you know what? I can even tell my girls this all the time. Thankfully, I baptized three out of the four girls. I have a fifth boy who's younger. But the one girl who isn't baptized yet, that isn't a Christian, I speak to her variously. Sometimes I will warn her and underscore the fact that she is depraved and this is why she doesn't come. But then on the other side, I say, sweetie, if you really want to come, if you really want to believe, if you want to come to God, God's way, as a guilty, filthy, hell-deserving, empty-handed sinner, coming to God through Christ, then come. Mm-hmm. Do you remember Jesus said something like this? Okay. I'll paraphrase it. If any man has desires to know whether or not my doctrine is from God, he'll know. I mean, that fits in our Calvinism, Ricky. Mm-hmm. It fits in our Calvinism, because I can say to my daughter, if you really want to believe, if you really want to come, then come. And then having come, you can look back and see that it was God at work in you all the while, creating this desire in you to come the gospel way.
Yeah.
So I think this view of man's inability, it answers many objections. Now, if you get Sam's exposition, which you really need to if you don't have it, you can go to his chapter, and he actually has a section in there where he addresses, I think, 3, 4, or maybe 5 objections to total inability in this chapter. And they're very excellent answers, very common objections and excellent answers to those objections.
You were talking about that. It's always interesting. And a book I've had to read is History of the Baptist by Robert Torbett. And when he gets to Spurgeon, he just talks and goes, well, he's a moderate Calvinist. And you get there, like, if you've read any of Spurgeon, you know that's not the case. Spurgeon is strict in his reformed idea. But I think you get to that point. He was so willing to call everyone to come.
Right.
That Torbett, who is, I believe Arminian really doesn't know how to deal with. How does this Calvinist be so open in it? And I think, you know, this, so that's just an important point that, you know, that which really separates Reformed Baptists from hyper-Calvinism, that, you know, we give these free offers and knowing that it's God who does the work and that he will bring those to save, but they have to hear.
Right. Yeah, I would argue, Michael, that Spurgeon was a historical Calvinist. Now, historically, we define Calvinism. It's not wrong to historically define Calvinism by the canons and Calvin. Let's put it the other way around, because Calvin predated the canons. So you got Calvin in the 16th century, then you got the canons in the early 17th. And if you read Calvin, if you read Calvin, see, that's the problem. We don't read first original sources anymore.
Yeah.
We watch a podcast about Calvin, and then we pop off our mouth like we're an expert on Calvin. But you need to read. In one sense, guys, this is a podcast, so I don't want to speak negatively. But in one sense, I'm actually glad that I became a Christian and cut my teeth before the internet. Because You know what I had? Calvin. I had Spurgeon. I had Edwards. I had Owen. I had Boston and Bunyan. Those are the guys I read. And when you read the guys themselves, then you can speak. But until you do, then just be quiet and wait. Okay, I mentioned the canons of Dort. That, of course, the canons of Dort, where we get the 5 points of Calvinism from, which were in response to the 5 points of the Remonstrants that were the Arminians. Mm-hmm. And who wrote up their five complaints, or the five doctrines that they no longer believed in the early 1600s. And then we responded later in about 15 years with the 5 points of Calvinism, or the canons of Dort. Listen to what one of the articles are. It says this: it is not the fault of the gospel nor of Christ offered therein. See, these hyper-Calvinists and their aversion and dislike for offer and these kind of terms, if you just read the canons of Dort and Calvin, they didn't have problems with these terms. It is not the fault of the gospel nor of Christ offered therein, nor of God who calls men by the gospel and confers upon them various gifts. Listen, that those who are called by the ministry of the word refuse to come and be converted. Look, sinner, if you don't come, you refuse to come and be saved, don't blame God, don't blame Christ, don't blame the gospel. Mm-hmm. Then who should we blame? Well, listen to the next sentence. The fault lies in themselves. And then it goes on to say, but if you do come, don't take the credit.
Yeah,
that's Calvinism. If you don't come, you're to be blamed. And if you do come, you don't get the credit.
Right.
But let me quickly, I mentioned Sam in his exposition of this paragraph of this chapter, particularly of paragraph 3. He gave those objections from the Arminian, then he responds to them. But let me just give some of his responses, his summary responses to the Arminian's claim that it's not fair for man to be so depraved. How can man be responsible if he cannot come by himself? And what about the clear teaching of the Bible that God calls men to come? It doesn't, the fact that God calls men to come mean, translate, doesn't that translate into the fact that man is able to come? And what Pastor Waldron mentions is, first of all, he talks about that distinction that I made between natural and moral ability. Man has the natural ability to come, and that he has a soul, he has the faculties, but he doesn't have the moral ability to come because his faculties are corrupt. But then he also goes back to point to this truth, which is important, and it goes back to paragraph 2. Man was made in Adam with a good heart and a good will. So don't blame God for man's fall. Remember, man was represented in Adam. So when the Arminian or the sincere Christian says, how can God hold man accountable for not doing what he lacks the ability to do? We say, well, one, he has the ability naturally, but secondly, he had the ability originally. You know, Ricky, if you got your paycheck and you spent it all on 40 ounces and crack cocaine, well, let's put it to something better than that. Let's say you get your paycheck and you spend it all on the works of Spurgeon and Edwards, and you can't pay your creditors. Is it you don't have any money and you go to your creditors and say, I don't have the money to pay it. I spent it on other stuff. Is he still going to hold you accountable? Of course he's going to hold you accountable. But if you don't pay it, he's going to put you in the prisoner's, in the debtor's house. They used to have debtor's prison. So just because you can't do it doesn't mean that you're not responsible to do it, because you had the means, Ricky. Right. You had the means. You just squandered them. Okay. And then he goes on to give the last one I'll mention there. He talks about it's ordinarily through this inability to come, because man is so corrupt, that God, by the Spirit, causes man to look for a remedy outside of himself. And so there's a sense in which a holy despair, that's what the law is, right? The law comes to you, Ricky, and says you have to be perfect. And do you know why the law says you have to be perfect? Because you were perfect in Adam. You were created perfect. And God's standard, what you owe God, isn't lessened just because you lost because of your own sinfulness in Adam. You sinned in Adam. It's just because you lost the ability to render to God what's due him doesn't necessitate God to lower the standard of what's due him. You still owe him perfect obedience to the law. And so the point is, the law, the we preach the law, right? In evangelism.
Yeah.
The law shows a sinner what God demands and what he condemns if you don't have it. And so the sinner has to come to see that he doesn't have what God commands him to have. And then he has to also come to see that God graciously provides it in another. Mm-hmm. And so if you go back, I'm not really doing him justice, but if you go back and read the chapter, it's very, very, very helpful. So that brings us then to quickly cover the last two. The fourth paragraph talks about man in his state of grace. When God converts a sinner and translates him into the state of grace, he frees him from his natural bondage under sin, and by his grace alone enables him freely to will and to do that which is spiritually good. So here so far where we have the affirmation that because of grace, see, it's all grace. God now graciously has changed our hearts and empowered our wills to desire that which is good. And that all comes after, we could say, post-regeneration and salvation. But then it goes on to say, it clarifies something. Yet, so as that by reason of his remaining corruptions, he does not perfectly, nor only will that which is good, but does also will that which is evil. So the confession here is affirming the great and wonderful truth that Christians can now, by grace, will, desire, and do good. And Ricky, it is an important truth to remember. Christians are good by grace, and they do good by grace. And our works, because the Bible calls them good works, the Bible says that God delights in our good works, and he rewards our good works. But we just have to remember that they're good works by grace. Remember, they've been prepared beforehand. And then one of the proof texts that our confession gives is Philippians 2, 12 and 13. Where we're told to work out our salvation because it's God who's at work in you to cause us to will and do in harmony to his good pleasure as made known in the Bible. So Christians now have a new heart and they now want to do good and they will to do good. But the other proof text they have in relation to that the last part of that paragraph is Romans 7. Which I don't know of any real older exegete. I mean, I know the Pelagians and the Arminians typically like to view Romans 7 as describing Paul and converted. I personally don't know of any older Reformed divine who did not believe that Paul was converted in Romans 7. I mean, how else can you understand this? The guy in Romans 7 loves the law. He delights in the law. And then he tells us in Romans 8 that the natural man who's not a Christian hates the law. So how can he love the law and hate the law at the same time? You know why it is that most of these modern supposed Calvinists don't like to say Paul's a Christian in Romans 7? Because they don't like the law. Almost all of these neo-Calvinist Christians, and there's a lot of good ones, I'm just saying, they tend to be what's called New Covenant. They don't believe the Ten Commandments is a continual standard of righteousness for the New Covenant Christian. And this person in Romans 7 is loving the law. So the way to get around that is to say he wasn't a Christian and he was doing something he shouldn't be doing. And that's why he felt like a wretched person. No, the reason why he felt like a wretched person, Ricky, was because he wasn't able to will perfectly to do the law because he loved the law. And that made him feel wretched. But there's coming a time in the last paragraph when, thankfully, we will only will that which is good and will never again will anything contrary to it. Before we come to that last paragraph, let me just back up and say one last thing about paragraph 4. And it goes back to the doctrine of regeneration. Because in the doctrine of regeneration, we maintain that the whole, H-W-O-L-E, the whole soul is renewed. Every faculty of the soul is renewed, but no faculty perfectly renewed, right? So that means that my mind is renewed, my heart is renewed, and my will is renewed. But neither are renewed perfectly. So there's still remaining ignorance, and there's still remaining corruption, and I still will to do things that are evil. Now, for the life of me, on a practical level, I don't know how anybody could deny that Romans 7 is describing a Christian because it describes me. Romans 6 mm-hmm. describes me. Romans right. 7 yeah. describes me. Romans 8 describes me all simultaneously.
Yeah.
Because the things, look, if you read Romans 7, the things that I don't want to do, mm-hmm. That means my heart has changed and I largely want to obey God. The things that I don't want to do because my heart has been renewed and my chooser renewed, I do or I will to do way too often. And this is a great cause of lamentation for him. And then, of course, he ends that passage down there, I think in verse 24 of Romans 7, in anticipation that Jesus is going to one day deliver him from the remaining corruption. Okay, so let me put it like this. To the extent that the flesh remains in man, and of course the flesh is a biblical term for remaining corruption, mm-hmm. to the extent that the flesh remains in man, the flesh remains, here it is, flesh or fallen corruption. What does Paul describe it as in Romans 7? Evil. Ricky, another way of putting it is, while we're no longer in the flesh is in us.
Right.
Or another way to put it, MacArthur helped me with this one time. He said, though the flesh doesn't reign, it remains. Mm-hmm. And that's a tragic fact. So we want to do right. We want to do will. And yet at the same time, there's something in us called the flesh that's remaining corruption that's tempting us. And if you go back to that text in James 1:14, that's enticing us to do evil. Ricky, you don't need a devil to entice you to do evil. You don't need the immoral woman of Proverbs 4, 5, and 6, 7, 8, 9, or whatever it is to tempt you to do evil. You don't need the world to tempt you to do evil.
Yeah.
Because this you have the greatest tempter in your heart.
Yeah. This is something that Pastor Fred actually helped me with because I used to say often, and not really realizing what I was saying when I was saying this, I would say, well, you know, when I was evangelizing people or talking to people, I'd say, you have this, when you're in Christ, you have this new nature and it's at war with this old nature. But, right. you know, like Pastor Fred was saying, like what you were saying here is it's the flesh, not the nature. Your nature is yeah. new. You are a new creation in Christ, but right. that flesh remains.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the best way to look at it. Otherwise, it's confusing. Because if you go back and read the Romans 7, there's clearly a dominance in the new man to do right.
Yeah.
And yet there's this remaining principle that contradicts it. Now, to be fair, men like Pink did believe in the two nature things, but I think Pastor Fred is far to be preferred there.
Yeah.
Okay, and then you find the last paragraph, which is a beautiful one. It's really a perfect way to end, and that is, this will of man is made perfectly and immutably. See, it's going back, isn't it, to the previous paragraph where it spoke about man in paragraph 2, but yet was mutable. Now, that's how man was made at first, but guess how he'll be made at second. This will of man is made perfectly and immutably free to good alone in the state of glory only. Okay, so here's here's Richard Barcellus to close with his book title, The End is Better Than the Beginning. Okay, so the second Adam comes into this world to do what the first Adam could have but didn't, and what Adam, the first Adam's posterity, cannot do. And he came to recover us and earn for us life eternal in a paradise that's better than the first. And the paradise second, which is heaven, is better than paradise first, which is creation, in two ways. Well, more than two ways, but let's say two ways. One, paradise, the second, has no serpent in it. Secondly, paradise, the second, our state will be immutable, whereas Adam's was mutable. Yeah. Adam was made perfect with the potential to fall. In heaven will be perfect. Heaven, the final state, which will be on the new heavens and new earth, we will be perfect and unable to fall. So the paradise that Adam the second earns for us is better than the paradise that Adam the first lost for us.
Amen.
Michael? So
going back to your comments on Romans 7, so you're not going to go by the new Baker commentary from Dr. Schreiner, where I think he actually moves away from what he posted in the original edition, if I remember right. That was at least a rumor at school.
Do you remember what he posted in the original and what his newer view is?
I believe he was more ambiguous on what he thought it meant in the first one. And now he's, after some articles have come out more recently, he argues that this is Paul kind of just talking of a non-Christian idea, looking at kind of his big thing from what I could tell is that you have this idea of the that you know the law can't do it, but then you have the Spirit. He has been convinced as of recently, but he's also known to flop positions quite regularly, especially in eschatology. So this could be just one of those things.
Well, he's been really wrong on the law for a long time. My personal opinion is, why buy him at all when there's so many better guys? Now, there is Martin Lloyd-Jones, and everybody's quick to point to him, whose view on Romans 7 was unique. It didn't really fall into either category. It didn't say he wasn't a Christian. It didn't say he was. But Martin Lloyd-Jones just erred there, and that's okay. But he's the only really reformed. And he wasn't even confessionally reformed in ways. He was unique in so many ways.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is, if you really want to assert that Paul in Romans 7 isn't a Christian, you have to wrestle with the fact that this non-Christian delights in the law and longs to obey it. And that's a big problem to me. Mm-hmm. And if you just see that the law, as summarily found in the Ten Commandments, is transcovenantal, then you can go to the Psalms and find David delighting in the law, and you can go to Paul delighting in the law, and basically say they delight in the same law. The interesting thing is that some of the people who don't like Romans 7 as viewing Romans 7 as a Christian make much out of delight, the term delight. And the interesting thing is that the Bible speaks about delighting in the Sabbath and delighting in the law as much as it speaks about delighting in anything else.
Yeah, I know one of my elders is a PhD student. So I'm in Louisville. One of my elders is a PhD student at Southern under Dr. Wellum. And they have talked extensively quite a bit about Wellham's view of the law and this progressive covenantalism. Now he holds to 1689. He disagrees with Wellham at this point with that. And I know he has made comments on how Wellham's like, well, essentially we agree, we believe the same thing. And it was kind of, that's kind of maybe Dr. Wellham's cop out on that, you know, in that way.
I would just say, Michael, there are so many good books, most of them written centuries ago, some of them written more contemporarily, more recently. Why even waste your time on reading those men? Now, if you have to read those men because you're in school and you're forced to read those guys, then you read them critically. But I've always encouraged, and I continue to encourage all my young guys, to just buy the best books. Look, man, I'm never going to read these books. I'm taking them to the church library to let others read them because I'm never going to read all of them. I get that. So I'm just buckling down on the best. I'm buckling down on Owen and other men like that who are worthy of deep reading. And why would I even waste my time, to be honest, reading these new guys like that? I would encourage people to read the old guys who are confessional. And if you're not confessional, I probably won't read you, period. I know that sounds kind of narrow, but why would I read you when there's so many confessional men I'm never going to read? I mean, I might read you to see where you're going and to be critical and stuff like that, to stay up on things. But even then, to be honest, I'm not all that for staying up on things. I'm just trying to keep up on overseeing the 40 families that the Lord has entrusted me with and just making the 3-4 sermons I make a week.
Well, this has been a great conversation on chapter 9. I really do appreciate you coming on, Pastor Mike, and kicking this series back off again for us. Looking forward to getting through this. And as you mentioned, the book from Sam Waldron, the exposition of it, we are planning on giving one of these away at the end of the series. I want to give one away to a listener, and we don't have all the details on how we're going to do that yet, but giving that away. Along with a 1689 copy of a 1689, so this way, you know, the listeners can listen to this series, understand what's being said in the 1689, and then even dig deeper into maybe what we wasn't able to cover in this series as a whole. There's 32 chapters in the hour time or less time that we have, and so hopefully that will be beneficial to a listener out there. But you'll have to continue to listen to the series and find out how we're going to do that. This is chapter 9, and we've got 32 to go. So, well, not 32 to go, 32 total. So you do the math and figure out how many more we got still to come. So Pastor Mike, thanks again for coming on. I really appreciate you, brother, and always enjoy having you on to teach us from the knowledge that the Lord has given to you as you've studied and read from so many of these older Puritans, and explaining this chapter with us as well as the other chapters. I believe that you gave us, I'm trying to remember which chapters you did. I know you did chapter 4 of creation, and that was important too, you know, going back. And as you said, they all build upon one another. And so I encourage the listeners to go back and listen to this series.
Thank you, Ricky. Nice meeting you too, Mike.
Yep, nice seeing you.
All right, well, that's been G220 Radio for tonight.